Racehorses run faster than they used to. It's not because of better breeding or new training methods. No, scientists say it's new ways jockeys are guiding their horses using the laws of physics. NPR's John Hamilton has more.
Hello, way they go!
From the instant the starting gate opens, a modern jockey is working really hard.
Now Zeta Blue right there in second.
During a race, a jockey's heart may exceed 180 beats a minute. Frankie Lovato rode more than 15,000 races before retiring a few years ago. He says all that exertion by the jockey is making it easier for the horse.
While the horse is running underneath you, you're basically trying to be weightless on top of their back. And instead of inhibiting their rhythm and their stride, you're actually encouraging it with your upper body, with your arms.
Now scientists have some data to back up that claim. Alan Wilson is a professor of locomotor biomechanics at the Royal Veterinary College in the UK. He's part of a team that was trying to figure out how much energy a horse uses to carry a jockey. As part of that effort, they began studying the history of horse racing. And they noticed that jockeys in the UK had radically changed their riding posture in the early 1900s. Instead of sitting upright in the saddle, they began to crouch and put their weight on the stirrups. Wilson says it was an American jockey named Todd Sloan who developed the new style.
This guy, Sloan, was banned from riding in the US and moved to the UK in 1897 and started riding horses in that way here. That style was quickly adopted across UK racing over the next 5 to 10 years.
And winning race times improved by 5% or more. Wilson says that suggests the new posture greatly reduces the effort required to carry a jockey. To find out, his team began using sensors to track the relative movements of horse and jockey on the track. Wilson says the sensors showed that while the horse moves up and down with each stride, the rider doesn't.
The jockey's a bit like a person skiing down a mogul field. Their feet are going up and down, but their body is following a smooth path.
The jockey is also compensating for the rocking motion of each stride. All that compensating reduces what a physicist would call inertial losses. And Wilson says that's why it's become easier for a racehorse to carry a jockey than, say, a sandbag of equal weight.
A jockey standing up and using his legs like pistons to isolate himself from the movement of the horse. The horse has to support the jockey's weight, but doesn't have to move the jockey through the horse's movement.
Wilson says there is a catch, though.
It's really quite difficult to do. If you actually ride on a horse or ride a horse simulator, it's actually involves quite a lot of balance and coordination, because you're standing connected by your feet to something that's bobbing along at 40 miles an hour.
Even so, Frankie Lovato says jockeys have continued to find ways to ride more efficiently.
As time went on, and we got into the 30s and the 40s, jockeys rode with shorter and shorter stirrups and found that it was a more effective way to make a horse run faster.
And Lovato says in the past decade or so, they've begun to study digital images of races to refine their technique even more. They've also begun practicing on something Lovato invented called the Equisizer. It's an artificial horse that lets jockeys simulate the experience of riding a race. The new research appears in the journal Science. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Now, for most of us, the state of the moon won't have much effect on how our evenings go tonight. But on a recent night on the shore of the Delaware Bay, a full moon was a signal to start a really wild beach party. It's a party that's been taking place for millions of years. And for Louisa Jonas of WYPR in Baltimore, it's one of the highlights of the season. Here she is with the first of two reports from the water's edge.
I want you to imagine you're stepping back in time, say 400 million years. We're talking before the dinosaurs, before flying insects even. Now, imagine you've morphed into a female horseshoe crab. You spend most of your time trudging along the bottom of the ocean, but tonight will be your night to remember. You're swimming to the shore, which you only do for a few weeks a year. Along the way, you meet that special someone, and he clasps onto the back of your shell. You and your mate crawl onto the beach, where you'll spawn at high tide under the light of the full moon. And you're not alone. Thousands of other horseshoe crabs are piling on top of one another. Your glistening shells cover the beach for miles. And because you're female, you're in for a treat. The mate attached to your shell is not your only tryst. Tonight, you will mate with up to 12 or 13 males, all at the same time.
Come with me, my love, to the sea of love.
Fast forward to the 21st century AD. It's three nights before the full moon. As a horseshoe crab, you haven't changed much. Dinosaurs may have grown wings and turned into birds. You haven't really needed to evolve. A master generalist, you've survived asteroids, volcanoes, and ice ages. Scientists call you a living fossil. And, like your ancestors, you know where to find a few willing companions this evening. The Delaware Bay shore is the site of the largest horseshoe crab spawning in the world. And tonight, you have some human visitors.
My name is Jordan Rutter, and I'm from Silver Spring, Maryland.
I'm Keith Rutter.
I'm Aaron Rutter.
I'm Pam Rutter, and I'm from Silver Spring, too.
We just love the whole phenomena of how once a year, or you know, for a season, the horseshoe crabs do this incredible mating on the beach. I don't know how anybody can watch this and not get excited about, you know, just nature and science and how things work in the world.
But the Rutters didn't travel to Pickering Beach, Delaware, just to watch. They came here to count. In the 1990s, the horseshoe crab population in the bay plummeted. So tonight, at the world's epicenter of horseshoe crab sex, volunteers in headlamps and waders will tally up the amorous crabs.
If the untrained observer, if you didn't know about horseshoe crabs and you just walked up on this beach right now and you looked out along the shoreline, you would just think they were shiny stones, thousands of shiny stones. And it looks like you could walk the whole length of this beach stepping from stone to stone. They're that thick. But when you stop and think that they're horseshoe crabs and how many thousands of years, millions of years, that they've been doing the same ritual, it, you know, can't help but touch you.
At first glance, it's hard to get sentimental about a horseshoe crab. Horseshoe crabs are weird. They're like armadillos of the sea. Their shells look like armored helmets, and their tails resemble swords. Then, consider their eyes. They have 10 of them, including one on that spiked tail that helps them tell time. And there's no such thing as safe sex here. About 10% of crabs die upside down when they can't right themselves during spawning. Stu Mickles is a fishery scientist from Delaware Division of Fish and Wildlife. He's leading tonight's survey. Stu admires a single pile of crabs.
Okay, what we have is a congregation of spawning horseshoe crabs. There's a number of males on top surrounding a female who's buried into about 10 centimeters in depth. Attached to her rear is a single male, and he can fertilize the eggs exclusively if there's no other males around. However, there's lots of males on this beach right now, and they're all competing to reproduce with the female. And they will also emit milt and fertilize a portion of her eggs tonight.
In one sitting, each female lays about 4,000 tiny green eggs that look like clumps of pesto in the sand. In a few weeks, only the luckiest of eggs will hatch, and billions of eraser-sized horseshoe crab babies will wash into the bay. At exactly 9:04, high tide on Pickering Beach tonight, the teams get to work. Jordan, the eldest Rutter daughter, thrusts her French-tip manicured fingers into the foamy surf. She gropes the spawning crabs in a 1-square-meter grid, distinguishing males from females.
So there's 1, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I counted 4 females, and then I counted 13,
okay,
plus the ones you threw out.
It's not so easy to determine males. Who's who in the breaking waves, females, with the crabs sometimes 3 layers
female,
deep.
Female,
but the Rutters move fast. They have to cover 1 kilometer of beach before the tide recedes and the creatures disappear back into the water. Pam says she and Keith have been bringing their daughters to Delaware to count spawning horseshoe crabs since the girls were small.
You feel like you're part of the bigger world here. You know, it's pitch dark right now, and
all this is happening, and it's just, it's pretty amazing. Look at them.
By sunrise, most of the crabs will have vanished. But if it's been a successful spawn, so many eggs will cover the sand that the shore for miles will shine emerald green. Recent surveys suggest that the horseshoe crab population may be stabilizing. And everyone here hopes this latest count will show an increase in spawning. The crabs themselves are certainly doing what they can. Even after the tide recedes, taking most of the females with it, a few determined solitary males still patrol the beach, scanning the deserted sand for a mate. For NPR News, this is Louisa Jonas.
There are some dangerous, not boring, stowaways traveling on ships that transport goods around the world. Tiny organisms. They live in the water deep in a ship's hold. And in the course of their international travels, these microbes are causing havoc across the globe. NPR's John Hamilton reports on efforts to stop them.
The stowaways begin their voyage in the dark, far below decks, when someone opens a valve.
There it goes. There's the water starting to fill.
Mario Tamburi, a researcher from the University of Maryland, is shining his flashlight into a ballast tank on the Cape Washington, a 700-foot ship moored in Baltimore Harbor. Water from the Chesapeake Bay is flooding the tank.
The tank itself is about 650 cubic meters. It's enormous.
The size of a large swimming pool. And there's another one on the other side of the ship. The tanks allow large vessels to remain stable with different cargo loads. But they also mean a ship from Baltimore may be carrying millions of gallons of local water to Singapore or Dubai. And Tamburi says that water may contain billions of microscopic eggs or larvae from local sea creatures.
Even though lots of organisms die on those voyages anyway, it only takes a few that survive, 2 weeks going across a major ocean. They can establish themselves and establish a new population.
Once they are established, they are virtually impossible to eradicate.
Andrew Hudson advises the United Nations Development Program on international water problems. He says most species don't do well in a new place, but the ones that can survive are often so adaptable they take over. Zebra mussels from Russia, for example, have clogged the intake pipes of power plants and water treatment facilities along many U.S. rivers. That costs billions of dollars each year. And invasive species coming from U.S. waters can cause even bigger problems. One example, a comb jellyfish that has found its way to the Black and Caspian Seas. Hudson says the jellyfish is devouring tiny offspring from a fish called the kilka.
And the kilka fishery has, in effect, collapsed. And we've seen very moving footage of Iranian fishermen who've basically lost their livelihoods because of the collapse of the kilka fishery just due to this invasive.
Countries including the U.S. have tried to control the problem by requiring incoming ships to flush their ballast tanks in the open ocean. But that hasn't done the trick. So governments are preparing to impose tougher standards on ballast water. In response, several companies have developed systems to kill organisms in ballast tanks. Hudson says these systems need to be affordable and meet two other criteria.
They have to be highly effective in terms of drastically reducing the proportion of living organisms in that water, number one. Number two, if they use chemicals, they need to ensure that the water that's released is free of any kind of toxic chemicals that would impact on ecosystems as well.
Independent scientists need to test the systems to make sure they work as advertised. And that's what Mario Tamburi and his team are doing on the bottom deck of the Cape Washington. It's a space big enough for full-court basketball, but designed to carry things like tanks and Humvees and helicopters.
And it's been completely transformed into essentially a research lab for looking at how well ballast water treatment systems work to remove organisms in that water. And so we have a variety of pipes and tanks and areas for looking under a microscope and sensors and a whole suite of instruments.
Tamburi points to a pipe coming from the ship's engine room.
Water comes through that first 8-inch valve, and then it's split in two ways. Half the water goes into a control tank, which means it's untreated, just natural ballast water, and then half the water goes through a treatment system, and the one we're looking at over the next few weeks is a system that chlorinates the water and filters the water to remove the organisms.
A ship couldn't easily carry enough chlorine to get the job done, so they make it using electricity, which can produce chlorine from the salt in seawater. The chlorine is potent at first, but breaks down and becomes harmless during the voyage. Researchers won't know how well the system works, though, until they compare samples from the treated ballast tank with samples from the other control tank.
And the idea is that after 5 days, the treated should have very close to nothing alive in there, and the control should still have very high numbers, similar to what we brought on the ship originally.
Chlorine is just one approach to the ballast water problem. Companies are also trying to zap the stowaways with heat, ultraviolet light, ozone, and nitrogen. John Hamilton, NPR News.
The National Institutes of Health has new guidelines on stem cell research. One thing hasn't changed, and that's a ban on using federal dollars to create new human embryonic stem cell lines. That ban has been in place for nearly 15 years. Congress and President Obama have shown little interest in changing it. So that leaves new lines to be created in the private sector or in the states. But it's expensive, and few researchers are doing it. From member station KQED in San Francisco, Sarah Varney reports.
Here's the prologue to this story. In 2001, President Bush, who opposed human embryonic stem cell research, limited federal funding to less than 24 stem cell lines then in existence. Scientists chafed at the new rules, and the pace of the research slowed. When President Obama took office, he lifted most of the Bush-era restrictions. Scientists can now use federal funds to study any human embryonic stem cell line, and there are hundreds, as long as the lines meet certain ethical standards. The National Institutes of Health laid out those standards last week. Researchers can only work on lines derived from embryos that would have been discarded anyway after in vitro fertilization and from donors who give consent. Most scientists applauded the news. But Susan Fisher, a leading stem cell researcher at the University of California, San Francisco, says there is still a significant barrier to stem cell research.
The new regulations have done absolutely nothing to change our ability to make those cell lines.
Fisher made many of the lines that other scientists will now be able to study, and she did it without any federal money. That's because Congress has long banned the use of government funds for any research that involves destroying a human embryo, and the new Obama guidelines haven't changed that. In other words, scientists can now use NIH money to study human embryonic stem cell lines, but only after someone else has already paid to make them. And deriving a new cell line is expensive, says Fisher. It's an intricate, highly specialized process that involves careful oversight, pricey lab materials, and clinical expertise.
So when you come right down to the bottom line, it really takes millions of dollars to derive and bank and distribute new stem cell lines.
Just a handful of labs in the U.S. make new human embryonic stem cell lines. Most of them are in California. That's because California voters agreed to spend $3 billion funding the kind of research that President Bush had restricted. Though there are no hard numbers, the state appears to be the nation's largest source of funding for making embryonic stem cell lines. But with hundreds of lines already made, why do scientists need to make more? UCSF's Susan Fisher says one reason is the cell lines are finicky.
Most investigators now think that human embryonic stem cells that have been in culture for extended periods of time accumulate errors. It's almost like a hard drive that pretty soon it becomes useless.
But opponents of this kind of research argue there are other ways to create cell lines without destroying embryos. And indeed, stem cell researchers are in a bit of a frenzy over the discovery of what are called induced pluripotent stem cells. They're made from adult skin cells that, with a bit of chemical jujitsu, can be turned back into an embryonic-like state. The director of UCSF's stem cell program, Arnold Kriegstein, says much is yet to be learned about these modified cells.
And in the end, you may wind up with a cell type that doesn't really resemble what that cell type was like in the original patient. We just don't know enough about that yet. Embryonic stem cells give a much more faithful representation of what those cell types are. And so at this point, they still remain the gold standard that we have to compare these newer cell lines to.
With the Bush-era restrictions lifted, Kriegstein says scientists around the country are anxious to get their hands on the cell lines UCSF is creating. Indeed, Susan Fisher says her phone hasn't stopped ringing. But with Congress seemingly uninterested in lifting the ban on federal support for research that directly destroys embryos, California taxpayers will continue to foot the bill. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Varney.